I was going back to our old episodes. Uh-huh. So I uploaded all our episodes to YouTube. I forgot to tell you this. So
I noticed as the notifications
dropped.
To the
Rami and Marcus YouTube channel. We got one more subscriber on that channel. We've got 45 subscribers now. We've had 70 views though this week since I put them up, which was good. From the last time we had them on YouTube was pretty good. But the thing I was remembering was how we used to start the podcast in season one.
We used to have an intro that we record at the end and then send it over.
We record at the end and then do it at the front of the
episode. Was it effective? Was it good? Did people like it? Write into us. Tell us what you
think. Was it any good?
I don't know. Having watched them, rewatched them, was it good?
I don't think it was very good, but it was what we were doing at the time, so yeah.
And therefore it was.
How's it going, folks? I'm Marcus.
And I'm Rami.
And this is the podcast where we try and figure out what this podcast is about.
And what we do with our life. I think the problem is that we do it right at the end. We're knackered. And we do like six takes and we'd not get it right. We wouldn't work out who's doing
haggard.
It.
Haggard.
Yeah, yeah. Also, it was in the era when we were aspirationally trying to get guests on and turn into like a late night show host situation.
The theme at that stage was like kind of a coffee beer shoppy thing, like kind of a casually come in and that type. Is that what we're talking about?
Where it was like 15 minutes of chat, guest, and then we'd wrap up with the guest, weren't they amazing, etc. And then we do the outro, which tell people what the guest was coming up.
That's
you know what I mean? There was that kind of vibe.
There was. We haven't had a guest on in quite a while.
Do you think? Actually, interesting you bring that up. I feel like you may have you've cheated on me during the week.
Oh, did word get out?
I feel like I just don't know how mortally wounded to be. Like, should I be filing for a prenup? What's the vibe?
I'm doing the Tinder thing. Like, as in, so what I'm saying is, like, we never were exclusive. You know?
Wait a minute.
What we've got is special.
2 years later. And you're telling me it's an open relationship. It's an open podcast. Is that what this is?
Well, you've done it. You've been on another podcast.
Yeah, but I told you about it. I came with guilt. And it was right at the beginning. You know, it didn't mean anything.
Oh.
Didn't mean anything.
Yeah, there's some podcasts. So it all came in one go. So there's one. I was on a podcast. It was recorded during the week. I think it'll go out next week.
Mm.
So I can't say what the podcast is called because it's actually a brand new podcast. It's about tech, though.
But it's your podcast or someone else's podcast they've invited you on?
Someone else's podcast. Okay. Somebody invited me on to talk about product management and running AIML in software, how you create, how it's changed product management and the evolution of AI in tech.
Okay. That's not going to fly. She sounds like a tramp. That's fine. Next, what's the other one you're on? No one's going to listen to that. It's okay.
There's another one coming up, which I can't talk about, which is more focused on the construction space, but it is an Autodesk-owned entity. So,
look, if you were forced to, effectively an arranged marriage, I can forgive that.
Yeah, these are fine.
Yeah, I just don't want like a third and a fourth. I just don't want this to become a habit, you know?
Yeah, no, it was just a fling. It was just you know, end of summer, getting ready for the winter. Just to lash out another couple of podcasts. And
you need to go from there. You need to just sow your oats across the podcast ecosystem. You to rack up those views. You do what you need to do, you know? Just know where you're coming back on a Wednesday night. Was it fun? What was the experience? What any learnings from what we should apply to? Should we ever have guests?
It's so good being a guest on a podcast. No wonder our guests love it. Yeah, it's much nicer than being a host. Because when you're being a host, you spend the whole time making sure you're listening, but also making sure the pace is right. Like, are you getting onto
it? Some of us do. Yeah.
You and I were tag team, and you'd be doing the deep listen. I'd be doing the, are we getting momentum? And are we kind of getting along? Yeah. And we tag team that. But also, the hosts care about, you know, your answer's the right answer. Yeah. You know, as opposed to you and me who just endlessly either
chip away,
agree or entirely disagree with each other the entire time. And I think it's just kind of nice for someone to say, what's your opinion? Wow. You go, this is my opinion. They go, that's a good opinion.
She sounds like a young bimbo, mate. Great. That's what you're telling me. You're telling me she's 20 years younger than me and she agrees with everything you say.
I'm just
personifying the podcast that you're having these quote-unquote flings with some Vegas hotel, cheap one-hour shop.
Yeah, no, it was wonderful. It was really wonderful. I enjoyed it thoroughly. I would like to tell other people my opinion on things without being attacked back. Oh.
This has become a therapy session is what this is. You had to fly the coop in order to come back. And do we have any learnings? A, like when we bring guests on, should we ever bring guests on again? Or B, how we should operate? Like, should I be just asking you amazing questions about your life all the time?
You should ask me questions about my life all the time. That was my... No, I think, you know, The podcast I was on, I had been given the questions in advance, and I think like it was, you know, it was just, I really prefer the fluid style of us just chatting. Like like the reason we do this is because, honestly, it's easy and it's cathartic, and we talk about stuff we want to talk about.
Yeah.
I think that this was definitely a business podcast, and it was really enjoyable. I thoroughly enjoyed doing it, but it was also work. So, and that was different, you know. So,
I had that same feeling with the. It was actually more stressful for me. I'm not sure I enjoyed it as much. I like the thrill of presenting for work, etc. But
I
also had the questions beforehand. It's just a bit.
It's more similar to being on stage. It's like presenting. It's like when you get that rush from being like, I went up and I crushed it. But it's like, you know, you kind of know what they're going to. There's the odd question that's a segue or whatever. But like, you know, you mostly know. And I also had editing rights afterwards to cut out any of the stuff that, you know, I wasn't happy with, and that just makes everything safe, you know.
Well, I'm happy for you, mate. I can't wait to listen to it, critique it, and then, you know, down thumb it on YouTube. I'll listen to other people's podcasts. I'm not going to listen to ours. I'm going to create some anonymous accounts and just comment like viciously.
Spam it back.
Yeah, just community notes it on Twitter or whatever the equivalent is on Anchor. You know, just.
Well, I appreciate your honesty. That's great. Thanks for that, buddy. Speaking of Twitter, Segway. Segway. I'm delighted to say that Twitter, X, formerly Twitter, is now going to be charging $1 a year to folks in New Zealand and the Philippines as part of their Not a Bot campaign. I don't know how they picked
New Zealand.
I'm glad it's New Zealand. New Zealand knocked Ireland out of the Rugby World Cup on the weekend. So
we
are anti-New Zealand right now.
Totally. Yeah. Same. Always.
Well, you are. But yeah, you know.
What? As though there's like a strong bot nation? Is there a bot swell coming out of New Zealand?
That surprised me. I was like, when I think of New Zealand, I think of, you know, I think of lots of things, but I think of, I think of Lord of the Rings.
I know exactly where your mind went.
I think
and it involves something woolly is all I'm saying.
Sheep, Lord of the Rings, and seeing receptionist? And those are the three things that people think of when they think
fish and chips by the dick. Where beach days. I imagine it's like a VPN thing. So New Zealand, in like health space, famously has a great regulatory environment which allows you to beta like early test stuff without FDA or regulatory approval. So everyone kind of rushes over there and does these early kind of tests, and it's a really great kind of. I wonder if there's something like that in tech where there's like a VPN router, and so bots are going through there. That'd be interesting. Philippines. Yeah,
I wonder, or is it just that? Yeah. Interesting. A dollar a year is not huge, is it?
No.
I did hear that Musk is betaing, charging $1 per tweet. That he's doing. That he's like.
That seems trying to figure rich, out doesn't
charge it? Charge per tweet.
That seems rich. I can imagine the bots. I can imagine it just calls it a quality filter. Just don't retweet. Don't spam crap. But that seems rich.
Just rich people get to talk on this.
Yeah. Is that
platform,
what's going on?
Is it in this town square? It's interesting, isn't it?
I mean, it's the inverse of the news firewall, which I despise. And like, I get business model, like you have to survive, and the news industry has to survive.
I hate it
but
too.
You're
I hate
essentially
it.
Saying that journalism is no longer a public good. That's about informing the people. It's only people who pay for it can inform. You know, that's a disaster. Yeah.
I hate the ones as well that let you read three lines and then you forget. Like you end up on their webpage and you're like, you made me click the link and now I'm here and I want to read it, but I'm not going to pay. Wall Street Journal is a huge offender there.
The insiders, businesses, all those. Yeah. The $1 story is a micropayment story as well. I'm just going to get my little plug in there. So that's a... Can
something
you get
Stripe?
Yeah. So Stripe underpins some of the Twitter payments, but it's also, you know, in the payments industry, it's really hard to charge small amounts for these micro reads and micro payments because credit cards, for example, take a chunk and there's fixed fees and fixed cost for interchange for every payment.
20,
so
20
doing
cent,
micro payments is a tech challenge that's been evolved, you know?
Huh. Okay, so, cool.
Enabler.
Yeah, not interesting. Enabler. But thanks for bringing it in. Yeah, everyone loves talking about finance infrastructure. I feel like we should talk about that more in the podcast. That's, you know, deep into the guts of how financial payments systems work is probably the next key thing.
I'm here to tell you where the frontiers are. I'm looking around the corner where the unsexy, but, you know, hugely fintech is a, I don't know if you've heard about
it,
but it's a thing.
I know it's profitable.
It's a thing.
Google is even trying to tell me about it now.
Bloody good.
Muter.
Google and news, there's a segue. There's some serious layoffs that have happened in the last last week. Yeah, the layoffs have hit.
I didn't hear.
Continued.
In Google?
Google, yeah, Google. In fact, the news org in Google, so the team that does Google News apps, they've been hit. like substantially, and it's out
people
of,
we know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Out in the east, out in the eastern overseas, and out in the east coast. It's kind of devastating. But
oh, bummer!
It continues. It continues.
Something like 400,000 tech layoffs since 2020, since the end of 2020, not including COVID stuff. So, I mean, huge, huge change in the tech workforce, albeit everyone's just changing seats and getting jobs in other places.
Yeah.
You know, last week we were talking about Etsy and the how we were going to save San Francisco by having folks come in and sell their sandals and earrings and things like that.
But
as a fallback, maybe tech would help. Maybe the AI companies would help. Turns out AI gave tech giants a $2.4 trillion boost in their market caps in 2023. $2.4 trillion boost. So companies like Apple, Amazon, Meta, Nvidia. Obviously, Alphabet. Nvidia went from being a $0.3 trillion company to over $1 trillion company in that time frame. What's more interesting, though, I mean, all these tech companies, the answer is it goes up and to the right. Like, they're always going to go up. What's interesting about it, though, is that the time it took to recover from this tech crash that we've had with all we talk about these layoffs, it only took 18 months. Is it 18 months? Let me get my numbers right.
You can see it. The NASDAQ, right? You were saying.
Yeah, in 18 months, NASDAQ Composite recovered to 80% of its peak value within 18 months. The last time this happened, which was the dot-com bust in 1999-2000, it took 14 years to recover.
Yeah.
So like the cycle here, AI saved the day, basically. Not only is it going to save San Francisco's rejuvenation, it saves the day. Good news, all the major tech players are now worth even more. So, yeah.
Big tech just got bigger. It saved San Francisco, New York, London, and all the other financial hubs. Congratulations.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's still layoffs, as you're talking about, but it is interesting. It's a retooling rather than a layoff.
You know? Redistribution. But the stuff you hear of the number of applicants, and we're seeing a little bit, Aaron, you know, in the thousands for a single job. Admittedly, it's, you know, an influencer on Twitter posting it, et cetera, but you're seeing an incredible demand. And I don't know if there's enough jobs to support it, or maybe there's just spikes going on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Is it a really competitive market right now? I was kind of thinking that things were shifting. You know, because we had all this quiet quitting going on, and everyone had the upper hand with companies, you know, the individuals, the employees had the upper hand for a couple of years there. So we're seeing a swing back, obviously,
work. The other kind of weird economic from to don't understand the economy, the you know, S&P recovery / being reasonable up and to the right, et cetera, driven by, you know, seven stocks and they're all tech and everything else is actually still down 15% or 30%.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very strange situation. It's just not a normal economy. And
you know, a lot of companies are tech companies now. I mean, you'd argue with, you know, digitization that all companies, there's not every company is a tech company to a certain degree these days, right?
Yeah. Right? So they argue, mate. I don't think digitization makes it a tech company.
No, digitization maybe not, just on its own. But like, I don't know. I mean, the irony here is like the biggest laggard in all this is the financial, you know, I mean, you know, old school regs. Finance, like as in banks.
Regs.
Banks suck at this.
Yeah.
Never mind regs, like as in, their tech infrastructure and banking systems is just, deep, is archaic. Deep. Like it's, yeah.
Bloomberg's still minting though, don't worry. Was that the thrust of your chat on the podcast about construction? Did you get on there and say, look, construction is fundamentally a tech industry? Was that the chat? We now use iPhones.
You're so
and
jealous. 3Ds.
No,
you're
I'm not
so
je- jealous. I'm just trying to understand. I'm just trying to understand the nature of the relationship. Like, was that the chat?
Why don't I talk to you about something I can talk to you about? Do you want to talk about the real estate broker commissions, the antitrust? Here, this is a thing very close to my heart here in the US. Not only do you get shafted for, it's 7% mortgages right now, which is insanely high mortgage rates.
Almost 8 for what it's worth.
Almost 8. Yeah. So nobody can sell their house. Another reason, when you're buying a house here, you have to have a realtor. When you're selling or buying a house, you have to have a realtor. And the person selling their house pays for the realtor of their own realtor and for the realtor of the person buying.
And they're not small fees, are they? They're not flat fees and they're not small.
5 to 6% of the value of the house. Now, so like for a $30,000, if you sell a $500,000 home. Now, I don't know where you buy that here in this part of the world, but
just,
yeah,
just as imagine. A number that makes you seem humble and not completely out of touch. A $500,000 home. Yeah,
exactly. I think that's the average home price or something, but like, I was shocked at how much money my realtor made, given she brought us to a few places, didn't do a whole lot in between, and then we bought a place. And
My issue is that it's indexed on the price of the home, and the effort is completely the same whether they did $500,000 or
they always win.
So
they always win. So there's this things I didn't know. There's a National Association of Realtors called the NAR. NAR, National Association of Realtors. And in order to even, they've trademarked the name realtor. So if you want to put on LinkedIn that you're a realtor, you must be a member of NAR. So I can't actually go on there and say I'm a realtor unless I'm a member. Anyway, so I thought that was genius. But anyway, of their members, the DOJ is going after them and being like, is this monopoly? Is this antitrust? It seems like you're the only people, you are NAR, are the only people who can have realtors, and it's a fixed 5-6% rate, and there's no alternative. And their argument is, well, the reason we do it like this, that the seller pays the fees for both, is to enable first time buyers and people of low income to get their first foot on the ladder, to get their first home. And I was like, oh, well, that's admirable. But can we drop it to 2%? So that's on my radar.
Oh my! What, is it active? Have they just filed a motion?
It's on right now. Yeah, as in DOJ is considering it. They have voiced. It was in the news. It's like it's underway.
Good.
They're getting a lot of pushback from these real estate broker commissions folks. But they're
Exciting. I'm just it's a breath of fresh air from going after, you know, Google or, you know, Microsoft. It's just a good. It's something different. Go after the old school. It's like hearing aid industries, you know, these things that have locked in
institutionalized industry. They're just in this little niche, and people forget
taxi medallions, that sort of stuff.
Incredibly lucrative niche.
And you feel it every time, but you only feel it when you know once in a while, once every 4, 5, 6 years. But
speaking
so
of
painful.
Speaking of systems that don't work as well, that should work better.
My
IRS.
Internet? Oh.
Your internet should work better. IRS.
About to skewer TurboTax, aren't they? They're going to skewer them once and for all.
So they are. IRS is releasing a free tax filing app.
Yeah.
How this doesn't exist already blows
lobbying.
My mind.
Intuit lobbying. Intuit lobbying.
Anyway, they're doing it in 13 states as a trial and immediately rendering TurboTax irrelevant.
Do you use
TurboTax? I bet you
No. I tried once and then I realized that I make a lot of mistakes and I'm not particularly fluent in what I actually do financially. So yeah, instead I use the other manual version of TurboTax, which is called H&R Block. I think they use TurboTax, but it's just a human interface with
them. Good job. We have a tax accountant because our taxes are kind of complicated with some stuff we're invested in, and we need someone.
Between Australia, UK, and the US, and in the US you have to file them across the board, and we're also on three different calendars because this one is calendar year.
You have to file in February and
Australia
April
is June,
November.
July, and the other one's in October. And you're like, can just the three countries align on the tax year? Anyway, mate, I love a bit of monopoly busting. I also love a bit of court cases that are interesting us. How's the Lewis chat? Have you finished the book?
I'm almost finished. I'm onto the last chapter, but I get it. I get the gist of it. I know what he thinks. I think it's a really interesting and controversial book for Lewis to release at this time.
For our listeners, what this is about, I'm going to take your role. This is a book from formerly The Big Short, the author of The Big Short, Boomerang, and other financial real-world scenarios that have happened. In this case, he happened to be embedded with SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried, famously the founder, entrepreneur of FTX, Bitcoin exchange, all crypto exchanges, that turned out to be complete fraud, stole people's money, collapsed, and is currently under trial. And only when it collapsed did we realize that Michael Lewis, was riding shotgun with SBF.
Nobody knew.
No one knew, and because he was going to tell a story that was, look at this incredible hero, and it all collapsed while he was in that front passenger seat, and then he released his book, QuickSmart.
Yeah, he'd been following him for 6 months. The book is called Going Infinite, and it came out last week, and I devoured it. I've got so many opinions on this, and I'm going to forget some of them. I'm just going to lash them all out.
Okay, go.
One, it's clear to me that he started writing this book as a Mark Zuckerberg slash young savant genius person who, like, that's why he was following him around. Yeah. It's because this guy is
he's the scoop. Yeah.
He was just like a different person, doesn't have any emotions. People don't get him. He's learned how to smile and stuff, but his face still looks weird when he does it. I'm going to follow this guy around. He's going to be a trillionaire. That's why he started following him around. It's also the bit that I hate admitting is that I feel like Michael Lewis has got it wrong. I think he got too close to the subject and that he wasn't able to be objective. The third thing I want to get out there quickly is I feel like Michael Lewis had to release this book, given the opinion he has on it, right now as the trial is happening. Because
before
if it came out
the
after
juries.
The trial and he's guilty, it would have been. So the book is very positive. It paints him in an incredibly positive light, that he's just incompetent and naive, that he is a physicist and mathematician who views everything in life as probability. Like, he does all of these shorthand probability things. He's not like a maths genius, but he's very comfortable with ambiguity, creating probabilities out of ambiguity. So, for example, he loves games like Magic the Gathering, where you can't know a perfect answer and that things evolve over time, that if you have certain cards, they change. Like playing blackjack, for example, at a casino is one of the examples he gives, or poker. He wouldn't like the game of poker because there's fixed rules and he wouldn't be the best at it because he's not going to be the best card counter. He's not going to be the best at knowing the exact probabilities any moment. He'll know the rough ones. But if you change poker and then you say it like, what's the probability of in the next four cards that we'll get a red one? And then if we do, and then if you add all these like different, like what, how much would you pay to gamble with the guy sitting on your left that the next card he's going to get is a two? Mm-hmm. Like then he starts to get he's separated from emotion. He's very good at these probability calculations in his head. So he's really good in a chaotic environment where there is no real answer and you can be very unsure. So that's the kind of guy he is. And he's like that about everything, relationships, people. He doesn't have feelings. He admits I don't know how he got all these notes, but he's therapist and talks about talking with his therapist. And he's talked to therapists before that he doesn't actually have feelings and he's not like a true human in the way that other people are. He's learned to know that when people say certain things, he should make sure certain facial expressions. And you know, one of those people, basically.
So he's a standard someone who grew up around Palo Alto, is the vibe.
No, he's not. No, he's not.
You know, social cues, having to pretend to be human.
There's three people like that. And so, see, that's the thing. All of these, there are tens of those in Palo Alto, and then the entire community around them thrives on it because you need all the marketers and the social people and the HR people and the PR people to make it work, right? But most people are not like that.
Oh, I don't know. I think there's a pretty high density of spectrum folks in this area, as per like every generation, the parents and the kids and the things the schools are having to deal with and the therapists and the education system that's set up. I'm not sure it's an isolated situation. Anyway, not to make light of it, and not to say that he's like everyone else. Clearly, he's an extreme of whatever it is, but he's got traits, definitely traits that resonate with this area.
The other thing that I wasn't aware of is EAs. Have you heard of EAs?
EAs.
It's a big effective altruism.
Yeah, this was the ticket, wasn't it?
SBF was like, my goal is to give everything away, and I was like, sure. Yeah. But according to Michael Lewis in the book, his sole reason to make this money and to like get these multipliers is genuinely to make massive change in the world. And this effective altruism's approach is basically, you know, if you're walking down a street and the example he gives in the book is if there was a child drowning, you walk past a stream and there's a child drowning, you wouldn't weigh up the cost benefit to you of saving the child. You'd realize that you have to get into the stream and pull and fish the child out. But this is happening at scale in the world, and that you could literally save children from dying in this world if you gave all your wealth away now. And that therefore he feels like he has a burden of responsibility to earn the absolute most money he can. to give it away.
Yeah.
And that there's a big wave. There's actually a wave. Like, I'm not tapped into this.
It's a whole community. Everyone's
it's a community, but it's a Gen Z thing where you go and you earn, and you actually go into investment banking. You go into really high end earning jobs with the sole goal of giving it all away. I think it's just so foreign to me, but yeah.
I remember the EA chat like up front, and all the people who were critical of him were how much of this was a PR ruse to make it all very reasonable up front, the charity arm, the EA arm. And it was a really strong like VC and tech crowd around EA that kind of made it real. And I think, the devil advocate, the cynic would be, of course, that's what you do when you're embarking on this sort of thing, because it creates layers and layers of misdirection.
He was on this beforehand. You see, the thing is, he did this at university. He attended all these talks at university. He has been pushing for AE long before he stumbled into success in crypto.
Yeah. 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 Clearly,
that's
not close
the bit that surprised me. That's it. Because, you know.
I think the bit that did Michael Lewis ever do it as a real life follow around? I feel like all these other pieces were retrospective.
He followed him. He shadowed him for 6 months.
This is the first time he's met him.
This last 6 months he met him 6 months before things went tits up.
It does feel like he's been cast in the spell. One of the other famous things about him is that he's, similar to all of them, Elizabeth Holmes et al. There's a distortion field, and they know how to bring them in and keep people. And all the profilers on Elizabeth Holmes as well kind of wrote glowing stuff because she was so, so convincing. It does feel like he's taken all of the spin pieces and accepted them. How does he justify the fraud? Does he approach the fraud?
Yes. So, I mean, so that's probably some of the less controversial pieces. I think what he does do a good job is of humanizing people. Like, in The Big Short, when he's got like, he talks about that guy with the, who's also on the spectrum, who's got like one fit, he's got a glass eye, and he like listens to heavy metal music in the, like he does a really good job of like painting people warts and all, understanding their characters properly, things like that. So he spends a lot of the book doing that. And ultimately in the end, it's fresh for me, but it just feels like biased. Like it, given that there's a court case going on, it feels borderline like inappropriate to paint someone negligent. In that way. When negligent, like it's like, court of public appeal. Like is, you've got to find people who, I don't know. He's definitely taken sides. It's not like down the middle. He has taken a side here. And,
it's interesting to see how it plays out. Unfortunate hole he has to dig himself out of.
Given Caroline Ellison's testimony, that like he knew all this stuff, he told her to do it, she's got receipts, she's got emails. You could put those two things together and say maybe that was still a probability thing. Like he understood the probabilities, and it was like for
getting
him,
caught.
It still was negligent. No, but still. He paints him in a way that's like, so there's this one example where he's trying to get more women into crypto. Like, so he's got the Tom Brady thing pre-Tom Brady, but there's a lot of tech bros in crypto, and he wants to get more women involved. So they hook him up with, who's the editor of Vogue? What's her name? With the hair, The Devil Wears Prada.
It'll come to me. Samantha Winters.
Anna Winters, I think. Let's say that's her name. It's on the screen now. He has this call with Anna Winters. Famously, he's got ADHD. I don't know if you saw that this week. They asked to bump up his prescriptions in jail. Mm-hmm. He's got ADHD. He would play games, online games, war games, while being interviewed by Bloomberg on TV.
Super dismissive and super rude and the whole thing.
Yeah.
He was playing League of Legends while he was getting VC
League of
funding.
Legends,
and that
his
sort of
eyes
stuff.
Aren't even looking at you. Yeah, classic. Yeah. So anyway, he's on to Anna Winters, and she's asking him to fund Paris Fashion Week, like to pay for the whole event. And he's like, yep, no problem. And at the end of that conversation, she said she'd love to have him there, that she'd love for him to maybe pay for it, to sponsor the whole event. And he just kind of was like, yep. Which is a thing he does when he doesn't, he's very, very conflict averse. So he'll just say, yep, he'll agree to things. Even if he doesn't, like he used to do a thing that if you were saying something, he disagreed or he thought you were an idiot, he would just be like, you're an idiot. Like he'd have an idiot face on for you. But then he learned that hurt people's feelings. So he just started to smile and say, yep, and say and agree to things instead, which is really dangerous. So he's on to Anna Wintour's, and he's saying, yep, yep. And she says, great, it was really good talking to you. And he says, yep. And he hangs up. And he had no intention of ever going, funding it, whatever. And he just left it easy. As it was on the 5th of May. And as far as he was concerned, he didn't even need to tell her that he wasn't going to go till the 4th of May. Like, he was just going to tell her the day before. Loads of major events, like, you know, summits and meetings. He's had CEOs of companies that thought he was going to acquire them, fly to the Bahamas to him. And he said yes. And he had no intention of acquiring them ever. Like, so he was just one of those bumbling, just a non-functional human. Like, so that's the road that Lewis takes, is that, like, he was just he was conflict averse. He'd learned not to hurt people's feelings. He was comfortable with probabilities and numbers, managed to build this empire, but at no time should he have ever been making decisions, you know, like, as in like people decisions, or like interacting with people and things like that. So yeah.
It's super interesting if you're framing the fraud as a probability game, where it was, he had a percentage that he would get. Was it that he would go down? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's getting caught. It's essentially what it is, a probability of getting caught.
That's right.
And still, he knew there was a problem. Yeah. I don't know. Let's see.
Yeah.
Let's see what it looks like. But
yeah.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for the synopsis.
Yeah. I hope I haven't ruined the book. It's still worth a read. It's just a short book. It's only like 250 pages, right. You know?
He just smashed them out. He just converted.
He's a great read, you know? It's really easy to listen to.
He engages it very nicely.
Yeah.
Other things, speaking of inappropriate people without social skills, the Quest 3 that's come out on last week and started dropping.
What are they called?
The glass holes. So they've gone inappropriate. They couldn't find a better, adjective, than the original Google Glass, who walking around San Francisco and putting them and going into coffee shops and on buses, and people call them glass holes. And so they've gone, now they're called the Meta glass holes, because they're using the Meta Quest 3 around coffee shops, because it's effectively XR device. It's an augmented reality device. It's mixed reality, and it allows you to do full pass through, and people are doing it.
But the use case is that they're reading the menu for the place that they're in ordering.
He's got
a menu open on his hand, and instead of looking up at the menu in the plate, it's just like,
they're being douches. And someone had to do it. There's no question. But I think what you're seeing a lot of is people watching YouTube on the bus in XR, or like in an AR, or people.
YouTube's a great use case. I agree with that. Great use case.
All the content stuff that Apple were pushing in that promo, basically consumption in various places, and people are doing it now on Quest 3, and it's looking like a real, it's kind of like Quest 3 is the Vision Pro for the masses, is what's coming out, with the exception that their path through is a bit distorted. It's a bit shoddy. And, you know, it's kind of baubles and all that sort of stuff, but people are doing it.
If the pass-through is not that great, because one of the best ones on there that I liked was a guy who pours himself a real coffee in his house, grabs his AR tablet, which is floating in space, carries his coffee in his real hand out and his fake tablet in his right hand, and goes out in his balcony. He's got a lovely view, and he reads the newspaper outside, and he's like flicking through news and stuff, and he can make it really giant. That's nice, you know?
Super nice. You're seeing all the experimental use cases and where this really does change the future of computing. You can see this replacing the phone in many ways, form factor aside. But it's an exciting time. And people are doing dumb, fun stuff with it. There was one where, interplay this with the 3D scanning and the 3D tech around being able to replicate and scan the room and scan objects, where you bring your toy car, and I thought of you, and you just look at it and kind of move the car around, and that scans it. You get the polygon. Then you pinch it and create a replica of it. And then you use your Xbox controller and drive it around as though it's a remote control car around your living room with all the object interference and so on.
Yeah.
Just really...
little physics engines turning the wheels.
It's not just like overlay a thing on top of... It's both. It's like from real to virtual, from virtual back onto real, like doing that multiple times per your coffee and tablet moving, and really fun stuff happening.
As soon as it just looks less stupid. Like, you know what I mean? It's just going to take, you know what? It's going to take 10 more years until like a regular pair of glasses, and that's just a long time to wait for.
Even if it's not a regular pair of glasses, people are okay with it being goggles.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Do you see, so Apple have, they're not announcing, but there's been leaks about their low-end
A cheaper one.
Do you know how much it's going to be?
I mean, probably at $1,500 still, minimum.
Yeah, to 2,500, somewhere between 1,500 and 2,500 for the cheap one.
No one said cheap one. They just said lower cost.
Lower cost version. Lower cost version doesn't have the front facing screen, so you can see my fake eyes, which is a real down. So I'm willing to pay the extra $1,000 so that you can see fake eyes for sure. I don't know. It's interesting to see where they go with it, you know?
I mean, you'd be watching Quest 3 right now, wouldn't you? You'd be looking at that thing and seeing what's working, what's not working, where are the bugs, and then amplifying all the stuff that's Delta.
Did you buy one? You were so bullish.
No, it's still in my checkout. It's all sitting there.
You're not an early adapter, Remy.
Oh, no, I'm
you're
not.
You're not.
I'm not a laggard, but I'm definitely not early.
You're the early majority.
Something like that. I mean, on Quest 2, I was early. We'll see.
Yeah.
It's still in the checkout. I'm skittish.
Yeah. It's just a lot of money to be spending on toys.
Basically. Speaking of which, what a great segue. I did want to check in because I did have some chats with our listeners during the week, because that's what I do. I just go do informal surveys.
Your flatmate?
No, just other listeners. About your, stuff problem. Your gadget. Yeah. What do we call it? What, do we give it a name? Has it got an official name?
Gas.
Your gear addiction syndrome. Acquisition syndrome. Yeah. How's that going? Is it under control?
It's not under control, but it's not as bad as it was.
I see.
So we are still buying stuff at a much lower rate. There's a couple of things I didn't buy.
Slowed the rate.
I've slowed the expensive ones that I just, the big ones. What can I say? I probably have what I'm buying. So the rule I've set for myself right now is, it's like those no smoking books. When you start reading them, they say, don't stop smoking immediately. Read the whole book first. I'm going through the full finance thing and I'm feeling the pain of it as I do it and the embarrassment around what I spent money on and all that stuff, and forcing myself to look at checks and how much, where it went and all that stuff. And then the goal is at the end, I don't want to make any broad statements on here because then you'll hold me to it. But like at some stage, come out with a plan of action around what I'm going to do. It's probably going to involve changing my relationship with Amazon in some way. You know, I spend more than half of what I spend is on Amazon.
Wow.
And I don't just mean of purchases. I mean, like of all the money I spend, half of it is on Amazon. So,
wow. Yeah. Impressive. Oh, look, first step is recognizing. Very excited. Observation the listener I was chatting with was, as a listener, we could tell there's lots of stuff going in and out of that. Oh, yeah, as a listener, let alone as, you know, me.
A listener who doesn't know me?
Well, correct. Other than through this.
As a listener, they could tell that I buy a lot of crap.
No, because we talk about the toys, this, and, you know, capabilities, that. And so, yeah, it's a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. They don't know me. They don't know me. What do you call that thing where you think you know someone?
Parasocial relationship. That's what's developed right now.
You don't know me.
I don't buy anything. I certainly don't. No. I have no idea what's going on.
This is
right
just
now.
Your 100-kilometer, 160-kilometer runner again, isn't it? I've just got one enemy of your mates.
Different.
That don't like me.
He's the one who liked. That was the fan fiction.
Your mates don't like
that was
me.
The fan fiction. He loved your lols. He thought you were hilarious. I don't know why. Speaking of spending on stuff, did you ever get on the Cybertruck wait list?
No.
Ah, you're missing out.
Did you?
It's happening. No. God, no. I was never a candidate. I feel like
I knew it wasn't going to come out for 5 years. So, like, there's no point. Like, by the time we'd be in a different currency.
It's out in 6 years. It's right here. It's happening. There's a poster. End of November or whatever it is. November.
First deliveries. They've got a Cybertruck event, right?
Delivery event. It's happening.
So what was the deal with the tarp, the weird-shaped tarp outside your house?
A Tesla engineer lives across. He's actually renting one of the ADUs across there. He's a mechanical engineer, and he got the truck to do mechanical testing on it and fanged it up to Tahoe and back and put on 700 miles over a weekend and returned it.
Whoa.
He's going to get it next weekend. And he said, come have a ride.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, it's amazing how much attention they get. And, like, social is still flooded and accelerating. You want to come on my ride along with the – yeah, I'll be
here.
Yeah.
No. Can I go down to Palo Alto and get in the Cybertruck with you?
If we'll let you into Palo Alto, if your F-150 is allowed into the space. Yeah.
Here, no, this is real. Yeah. Can I go in the Cybertruck with you next weekend? Like, if I can get a pass from home?
You, if 100%. As soon as I have any confirmation,
so have you made enough
I'll call
friends
you
with this guy? Have you made, like,
yeah, we've known him for ages. We've known him for ages. I just didn't realize he was in Tesla.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I tell him, we won't tell anyone.
That's right. That was my first thought. He's going to say, don't take any video, and I'm going to take
it'll
video,
be our
and I'm
going to
splash it everywhere. Yeah.
It'll be our secret.
Yeah, yeah.
I really want to test ride in a Cybertruck this weekend. This weekend.
That's right. You need to. Next weekend.
This is, what's next weekend mean? Like in 2 days or in
what's
9 days?
What's a fortnight? In 9 days.
Okay.
Okay. Let me. I'll, as soon as I have confirmation, further detail. I will.
Don't let me down, Rami. Don't make this.
You'll be
one
the
of those,
first person.
Oh, a friend of mine, and it turns out someone, a cousin's aunt, nephew.
You'll be the first, mate.
I've got my calendar open here. This is how serious I am. Okay,
it's amazing.
We're going in a Cybertruck. Brilliant.
I am starting to think there's a Cybertruckification of design happening right now. You're starting to see Infinite Machines P1 is the name of the thing. It's an electric scooter, like moped, designed by like a New York design outfit and ex-UX designers from like software tech, and have created this box-like thing that is essentially, as Marcus Browning would describe, if you close your eyes and imagine an electric moped that was Cybertruck designed, this is it.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with Tesla, but and looks gorgeous, called Infinite Machines. Looks super fun, kind of practical, and has some interesting kind of storage treats. And it really feels, I think you're going to see a lot more. I think there's a trend here, and it's not they saw it and they went that way. I think they're ahead of it. They defined it and they went into the Blade Runner thing.
They're ahead of it, but also I'm just going to share a screen here. If you're listening on Spotify, you'll be able to see what we're talking about here. It looks like a scooter I had in the 90s, doesn't it? I mean, it looks exactly like one of those, the way scooters used to
boxy,
be, right?
Boxy. Yeah, I think the difference is that it's, I think the aesthetic is quite literally cyberpunk. It's Blade Runner. It's like Star Wars. It's the metal plates, the polygon, the kind of used, slightly aged stuff. And so I think it's essentially tapping into science fiction, like tech of that era. So Gen Z millennials, and then saying, here's a product that you can ride and pay for and do your own thing. And I think that aesthetic, they timed it really well. It's the equivalent to me of the superhero franchises happening in movies. It's when our age group who loved comics back then, superheroes, became the production companies in LA and so on. And I think now that's what this is tapping into. And like, kudos. That's really well done. You've tapped into
it. It looks really cool. I don't know if you can see what I'm sharing, but it looks fantastic.
It's gorgeous.
And it's got speakers on the side as well, so it makes rum-vum noises or something, does it? Or does it pump out music? I don't know.
Tunes.
Very modern.
And the whole front square thing is actually an LED.
Yeah.
And it's like LED strips. It's wicked. It's wicked.
But they're crazy expensive too, right?
$10,000.
$10,000. That's too much to pay for a scooter, dude.
Is it?
Yes.
Can we, how much did you pay for your last...
Would you buy one?
Look, I'm not the audience, am I? Would I buy it? No, probably not. I don't need one.
Yeah, you are. You see, that's the trouble. And also, motorcycles are too niche as well, and it's just not viable, is it? I have got money in on a motorcycle, you know that, on an electric motorcycle. I've had one in for a long time.
There you go, like a reserve.
Yeah, reserve. And the Super 73 are working on a motorcycle right now, and I put a reserve in a year ago or more, before,
That looks good. The fairing on that looks gorgeous. Looks beautiful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful motorbike. But I don't know. Who knows how much it'll be when it comes out. But I'm early in the reserves on that, at least. I'll get first refusal.
Of course, you can't follow through with that purchase given your newfound reduction in spend. Just to be clear.
No, the goal is to reduce. This is the goal, to reduce spend so that I can. I want to be thoughtful. I want to do the condo marry thing where you have a few things that bring you pleasure every day that you love, you know?
I don't know what brings you pleasure every day, man.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. You're fully justifying the next three scooter purchases.
Mate,
if I didn't have a motor transport and I was in an urban environment, that would need something. That $10,000 for electric scooter makes a lot of sense. I think it's awesome.
$10,000 is too expensive for a scooter.
What is it? It's $4,000 more expensive than the equivalent that's not like that, right?
Yeah.
No?
I did buy a Vespa. The Vespa I bought was probably about $8,000 that time, back in 2017.
Right.
So
It's the same. It's the same vibe, maybe slightly underpowered, maybe different range, but you know, it's a premium on what you would already get.
Yeah.
On my flatmates back, I would say after some drinks with some colleagues.
Oh, geez. You're going to smash in through the door boozy.
She's about to roll through the door and, oh God, tomorrow's going to be messy. That's all I'm saying. What's that? We're just in the middle of something right now. Yeah. Okay. We're going to be messy.
All right. Will I let you go then?
Oh, no. What am I going to do? It's going to be asleep in 3 minutes. going to be passed out.
Will there be a connection between the alcohol consumption and the next 3 days of struggling to see positivity in the world?
All of life's mysteries will unravel in front of us over the next 3 days.
Yeah,
people seem very difficult, we have no idea why. We still don't know why. It's a complete mystery.
Why is it
mystery.
So hard?
Very difficult.
Booze.
Headaches. It'll be mysterious migraines. No one knows how or why. It's really strange. Lethargy.
Oh, so
can't
good.
Sleep. Yeah.
It's
mystery.
So good.
It's a mystery.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it, love it, love it.
Mate, it's been a fun, action-packed week.
Yeah. What a good week.
This is good.
I'm hoping my kids go back to school at some stage in the next couple of weeks.
I'm
but
so
yeah,
sorry,
would
mate.
Be good. Yeah. Would be good. Briz, do you know what I forgot to tell you about? The thing that I was sad about. Can I tell you one thing that's sad?
Yeah.
Goldman Sachs, and you went off on your tangent. I tried to tell you about it, but
The
CEO of Goldman Sachs has declared he will no longer be DJing gigs. Have you heard about this?
I love that he was a DJ.
The CEO of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah. Yeah.
His name is David Solomon, and his hobby was DJing.
Yeah, like, and he used to do it at the work parties, and then he'd go out and do it.
He'd do work parties,
events,
but he did some fun events as well. Yeah. Like, he kind of did it for friends and family, and some of those friends are influential, and they turned out to be big gigs. And he loved it. That was his passion. And he said it's creating too much distraction from his job as a CEO, and that he's not going to be doing it anymore. And I think that sucks.
Are you feeling for him? Are you feeling for David Solomon just in terms of his work-life balance is just ruined now?
Well, I just think it was a good example of someone who's got a hobby. Like, you know, I think when you get to a certain level, you're supposed to not have hobbies. You're just supposed to work. Like, I get the impression Tim Cook just works. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think Sundar Pichai just works.
No,
you know, I think.
I watches a lot of cricket. I think Tim just is eating down at Etan or whichever.
Okay, it's not in any way competing with him doing work email or being available 100% of the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I think that there's these acceptable pastimes. Like, if he was playing golf.
That's right.
Like, if Ben Solomon was doing.
In aid of the community. Yeah.
If he was doing 4 hours of golf every Sunday morning, or even every Friday or Thursday, if it was during work hours, 4 hours of golf every Thursday morning, people would totally understand it. He's probably meeting with customers and it's probably a thing. And, you know, that's what. But, like, because it's DJing and it's non-conventional, like, I just feel like. Maybe I'm sensitive to this because I have a YouTube channel and I'm like, I still work really like hard at my
some
job,
projection.
But I've got
there's
a
some
YouTube
projection.
Channel.
Yeah.
There's projection
there's
there.
Some projection.
But it's also nice to be able to hold up successful people and say, these people have two separate personas. He's clearly a very serious person who's running a financial institution and he likes DJing gigs. Like, that's really nice juxtaposition there. Like, and it's a pity that
it's lovely. It's creative and other. Yeah. I'd love to know what the backstory is and just how distracting it actually was and who made him not do it because
shareholders, it probably came up. It must've come up with the very first shareholder and just been like, come on, dude.
And like something must've turned around. Something mustn't have been going particularly well. And they had to kind of,
you can only do that when everything's up to the right.
Exactly.
As soon as it's like, then it's like, well, what are we not doing here? Well, you're DJing sets on a Saturday. What the hell are you doing? You
Let's know? Claw that back.
Yeah.
Claw
yeah.
that time right back. But at the same time, you know, as you say, acceptable stuff. If you're committed to fitness and you're running and you're posting about it as CEO, if you're trying to do things that are, you know, there are
people
definitely
are like,
acceptable
oh,
bounds
my 5
of spare
a.m. club, I get up, I meditate,
the
and
hustle.
Then I go for a run. And then it's like, oh, that's okay. But if I get up and I do a DJ gig, it's like, what are you doing? Focus on the business. You're distracted from the business.
It's signaling. It's like, oh, I don't know. Maybe this is the harbinger of the recession, mate. This is how we know it's turning around.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
As long as we don't have to give all our money away to be altruists, then I'm okay.
I feel like the EA movement died with SBF. I feel like everyone abandoned it very quickly.
Did they?
Everyone signed the pledge and then it all just went underground very quick because of him.
Oof.
As an aside.
Lad, pleasure talking to you as always. I'm going to let you go. I'm going to try and piece together these three pieces of podcast. If you don't notice, it's because I was successful, but Rami's internet sucked.
Whoa. Let's not point fingers. Let's look at the footage on social media and let them decide.
The reason the podcast didn't go out tonight is because Rami's internet and I have to piece this podcast together.
I think we should look at the footage and listen to what the official spokesman said about whose fault was this.